You almost made me cry in thinking about it. So there's,
I'm sorry.
So oftentimes, that's okay. When I talk about these things, I never, like, I'm a big crybaby and I cry about things all the time. So it doesn't, it's no big
we
deal.
We do too. So it's okay, including Keith. So it's okay.
I know I'm going to cry again.
Hey, Warners, welcome to Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the podcast that makes everything sexy again. I'm Rachel Pitts, realtor with BRG, and now loan officer with U.S. Mortgage. More to come on that. And mom of Roxy.
And I'm Gina Tremarco, founder and sales trainer at Pivot 10 Results and Carolina Improv. And we've got our favorite man. He's there somewhere.
I don't know if he's my favorite man, but he's on the list.
One of our
That's all I want.
There you go. Thank you.
One of our favorite men live from Costa Rica.
Lucky ducky.
Lucky ducky. How's everyone doing today besides Keith hiding behind a mosquito net?
I'm fantastic. I'm drinking from the waterfall of knowledge over here. As I mentioned in the intro, I have moved officially to the mortgage side of real estate, which is really fascinating since I've been in real estate for 10 years on the sales side. And, you know, actually mortgage is also a sale. It's just a different kind of sales. So it's really fun and exciting to learn these new things. It's really interesting.
And congratulations.
Moments of overwhelm, but I kind of do that kind of thing to myself.
Yes, you do. As yes. Do I. We both
so good at it. So good at it.
We both do that.
But we've got a killer episode coming up. You guys will love this. It's unbelievably fascinating.
I mean, some of us cried.
Some of us did.
I cried.
Some of us were too happy because they're in Costa Rica to cry, which I get.
And someone has a reason why he is not crying. Something with cacao.
Chocolate makes everybody happier. So there you go.
Keith, you have anything you want to add about what's new and exciting in your life?
Nothing to add about what's new and exciting, but this is a terrific episode. This is something that kind of changed a total outlook for me on hiring.
This really did get me thinking about hiring because I have a little bit of experience in recruiting. We didn't really get into that in the interview, but I what's the phrase she used? Ban the box, which we'll hear about. So our guest today is Michelle Sirocco. We'll talk a little bit about her in a minute, but that ban the box, when you're looking at applications, I've had to look at that and see where they don't check the box about a criminal background. But I personally, as a recruiter, I still went through the process of interviewing someone because I guess maybe it was my mindset that I'm not going to make any judgment until I talk to the person. The only time I made a judgment is when they left the box empty. Because we still would have to do a background check. So I would give them the opportunity. I'm like, is there something you want to tell me? Because it didn't mean they were going to not be qualified for the job. So we're going to get into that on this episode with Michelle Sirocco. She is Televerity's Chief Responsible Officer. She joined Televerity in 1999 and has held several leadership positions, including Chief Marketing Officer. Michelle is a strong customer champion with a tireless commitment to demand generation, excellence, and best practices. She earned her MBA from Arizona State University, where she also serves as an advisory board member for the Center for Services Leadership. She holds multiple certifications from Serious Decisions. Michelle's an avid TED fan and organized and hosted, I wish I would have asked her about this, TEDx Perryville Correctional. So I guess that's a TEDx in a prison. Does that sound
right? It must be. We should put a link to that. Take a look at it and put a link to it on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I will. So that's the first TEDx to be held in an Arizona prison. That's cool. Which looked behind the curtain of incarceration to show the potential that exists in giving second chances. In her role as Chief Social Responsibility Officer, Michelle is excited to further expand Tel Verde's social footprint to create even more opportunities that transform lives. She dedicates a significant amount of her time, free time, giving back to her local community by volunteering for the Phoenix Rescue Mission, Athena International, and is on the, I don't know how to say this, Airway Foundation's Board of Directors. So that's a little bit about Michelle. I thought the episode was definitely went in a different direction than I thought. Any other thoughts from either of you about the show?
She had a quote that I just have got to eat. What was it? Eat adversity for breakfast. I love that quote.
I do too. It's so good. I'm about to, when I walk out of here, I'm going to share it with the rest of my office. It's such a great, it's a great way to look at adversity because, and she talks about this in her story, that you can look at problems and challenges and adversity as problems and challenges around adversity, or you can look at it as par for the course and how are you going to overcome this the best possible way to learn from it and grow from it. It's a killer quote. Needs to be a t-shirt.
I know. Maybe that'll be part of our t-shirt line.
Yeah, next to put on your big girl panties. No, you didn't.
Yeah.
There's a, okay, hold on.
We're just going to get going and move on to this episode. Before we do, just a quick reminder, if you haven't had a chance to review or rate our show, please go check that out. Do that. You can access our iTunes account from our website and give us a rating and review. That's how we continue to grow our audience. So let's get going with this episode with Michelle Sirocco. Well, today we have Michelle Sirocco on the show, and we're really excited to have her. Michelle, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And we were really, really lucky because Keith actually met you, Keith Walters, our the other leg in our threesome, and he met you at a Conscious Capitalism conference. Is that right, Keith?
That's right. I met Michelle in Phoenix at the International Conscious Capitalism Conference about a month or so ago.
Keith, can you tell us a little bit, and for our listeners especially, what that is?
Conscious Capitalism?
Yeah.
It is an organization that celebrates capitalism and kind of expands the realm of it. It was founded by John Mackey and Raj Sisodia, and many folks know John Mackey as the founder of Whole Foods. It's just a wonderful group of people and a wonderful set of companies represented there. When I was there, Michelle's company did a presentation on stage, which kind of blew me away and created a buzz and a conversation within the group that kind of lasted throughout the conference as to, you know, a question of who you would hire and, you know, how can you address the shortage in the talent pool today through a very unique approach.
What was it about her talk that was intriguing to you?
Well, it started off with, and I cannot remember the names of the individual ladies who got up and presented their stories, and their stories surprisingly then went to them being in prison and being incarcerated for different reasons and their journey out, and the role of Tel Verde in their journey out of incarceration.
So we'll bounce that over to you, Michelle, because when we first talked, when we were getting ready to set up this podcast, your story is amazing. And I think that's what really plays into your role at Tel Verde. Could you give us a little bit of that background of your personal story and then how that plays into what you're doing?
Sure. So my personal story is, I always never know where to start the story, if I should start at the beginning or start at the end. So if I start at the end and talk a little bit about exactly what I do, I'm the Chief Social Responsibility Officer at Tel Verde, which is really a fancy title for saying I'm the Chief Purpose Officer. And Televerde is a company that is was built in purpose. So almost 25 years ago, our co-founder and CEO founded the company based on the idea that providing women in prison with jobs, training, and education while they were incarcerated would enable him to build a successful business and enable the women to transition out of prison to successfully and build kind of a meaningful and rewarding career that enabled them to be financially independent and to take care of themselves. And very specifically, because he was an old IBM sales executive, that's how he started his career, he believed that by teaching the women to sell, particularly technology, that he could give them a marketable skill that would enable them to be very, very successful in an industry that was growing and booming and less likely to be discriminatory against their felony background. So my job and what I do today is really, I just go out and like Keith was saying, I get on stage and I tell stories of purpose about the business and what we're doing and how it's impacting the world. And I'm uniquely qualified to do this because roughly about 25 years ago, I had made some choices in my life that in a desire for upward mobility and a misplaced entrepreneurial spirit found me living a life that looked a little bit like an episode of Breaking Bad and facing what I consider to be in some ways the worst day of my life, but in some ways the best thing that ever happened to me. And that was the day that I had to face the judge and listen to him tell me that he was giving me the maximum sentence of 7 years in prison. And I was a young mother with two children, and that is the moment when my life changed forever. But it was also the moment that led me to where I am today, because when I got to prison, I heard about this thing called Televerde that said if I was really good at the job, that I could get a job at our corporate office when I got out. And that was enough for me to say, all right, let's go. I'm going to learn how to sell and I'm going to be the best. And I'm going to use this as a platform to redefine myself.
That story floored me when you told me. And I know Keith had mentioned it to me, but hearing it come out of your mouth, and I love the phrase that you use, was it misplaced entrepreneurs?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's a perception when you think about people who go to prison and people who end up in trouble is in, you know, there's a perception that they're either, you know, uneducated, unskilled, incapable, ignorant, any or all of the above. But in so many of the cases, and I've spent my life now, you know, working, being in prison and then working in prison and supporting people at, you know, through their transition. And in most cases, it was people who had a desire for more in their life than what was readily available to them. They didn't have the resources to get the upward mobility they wanted. And so they found their own ways of making money and creating a better life for themselves. And so there's some of the most talented and entrepreneurial and innovative people in the world in prison.
And what's the founder's name again?
The co-founder and former CEO was James Hooker, Jim Hooker.
And what gave him the idea to reach out to women in prison? Do you know?
Yeah, well, so the whole story goes, there's a gentleman by the name of Ron Bell, and Ron Bell was involved in prison ministries, and he looked at the situation and recognized that we just weren't doing enough to prepare the women to be successful when they got out of prison, and he had a background in call centers, and so he started the call center inside the prison, and then about 6 months into it, he actually met Jim at a church function. And Jim was a retired serial entrepreneur. He'd sold off two computer technology businesses and was kind of looking for the next thing to do. And Ron and his partner were looking for funding to support what they were what they had started, because they didn't. And so Jim always tells the story is that when his first visit to the prison, what he found was there were 6 part-time callers, 1 part-time supervisor, 1 486 PC, and no paying customers. And he thought, wow, this looks like a great deal. And so really, because what he looked at was what he saw, knowing his background in technology and in sales, is there was a need, there was a demand in the market for really good qualified leads for salespeople. And he looked at the situation and said, if I can teach these people how to talk about technology and generate good qualified leads, then we can build a great business and give these women a great career.
That's so cool. And there's somebody that's close to me who has a son who is incarcerated, and she talks about the reality of it. You know, people will say, oh, well, they're getting 3 square meals a day in prison, and now it's like, but she, of course, and as you, I'm sure, know, Michelle, it's not as simple as that. And the stigma that's attached to people when they get out of prison in general, that people just, if they see your record, it must be so difficult to get work. So that's another side of things that's just so amazing about this, that it gives them the women the hope of having a actual career rather than just like, hope I can get a job after I get out of prison.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it's like you said, and I'm not surprised that you said you've got a friend that has a son in prison, because the reality of incarceration in the United States right now is that first, we're number one in the world at incarcerating people, with 2.3 million people in prison today. Which equates to 1 in 2 people have an immediate family member that's currently or formerly incarcerated. Or a statistic that that blows my mind every time I think about it is we have as many people with criminal records in our country as we do with college degrees. So the reality of it is that there are so many people that are being affected by this, that if we send people to prison and they go in and come out the same way or worse than what they went in, then we can't expect to get different results, right? So we're, as a country, we're spending $182 billion a year on incarceration, which I think would be fine if it actually were fixing the problem. But 70% of all people will go back to prison within 3 years. And the number one predictor for recidivism is joblessness. And more statistics, because I know so many of them on this topic, 76% of people will still be unemployed 1 year after they're released from prison. It's just, so we as a country, and it can't just be government and the nonprofits that are solving this problem, is businesses really have to get involved in saying, you know, how do we help fix this problem? So that's kind of one of the big things that we talk about that I try to raise awareness for. Because the other piece of it is we have a growing skills gap in our country. I just read yesterday that this is the 15th month in a row that we've had more jobs available than we've had people looking for jobs. And there are something like 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day. And so that skills gap is just going to get bigger and bigger. And so business has to start getting creative about how we're going to start filling the positions in our companies. And I think that one is, you know, looking at people who have a criminal record, because even in this market with such low unemployment, people with a criminal record have a 25% higher unemployment rate. So proactively looking to how we can engage and prepare that population to come into the workforce and the jobs that we need.
It actually seems brilliant to train individuals who are incarcerated for skill sets like this, because, I mean, it's literally you're sentenced to X amount of time and you don't have really anything to fill it unless you are reading or exercising, classically, yeah. You know, the vision of the...
We're all doing pull-ups.
And, or somebody constructively saying, hey, you know, here's what we're going to teach you. And this friend of mine whose son, he just got his sentencing finally. It had been a couple of years before he received his sentencing, and he's got a 10-year sentence. And the upside to it is that when he is released, whenever that may actually be, he will have a college degree, basically. That's like, I guess, in the federal prison that they have that set up, that he will be able to pursue his degree. So these individuals that out on the street maybe would be using their entrepreneurial skills. And you say that in a sort of jokingly way, but you know, these guys that are let's say selling drugs, because that's the typical stereotypical idea of selling drugs, of, you know, they gotta figure out their market. It's all sales as well. So there's entrepreneurialism in there.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm the product of a father who had been incarcerated for some point. I don't think we've ever talked about this, Rachel, but like I think all my uncles were incarcerated at some point. It's just what Italians did in the Depression in Chicago. Ultimately, he's the man who trained me to be an entrepreneur, because he was very savvy and very smart, because he had to do what he had to do to take care of his family. I'm not doing anything illegal, just so we're all clear.
No, but and it's true, though. I actually have a family. When you said that, Michelle, I actually do have a family member that now popped in my mind when you said the statistics. Like, I have a family member that was incarcerated at one time.
Yeah.
And you never think about it, because it's one of those things no one talks about.
Well, that's exactly right. It's everybody's, you know, kind of dirty little secret. And I would say, as I've started making it, you know, kind of my charter is to go out and talk about it and openly share my own story, which I didn't used to do for years. Right? I was always afraid how it was going to hurt my own personal career, or my own credibility. But as I go out and I speak and I get on stage, the number one thing that happens afterwards that surprised me so much the very first time, couple times, the conscious capitalism was one of the first times I was really, really overwhelmed by how many people came up to me afterwards and thanked me because I had enabled them or liberated them to be able to openly share their story. For example, there was two women who came up to me at that particular event afterwards. And they said they'd stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning laughing and crying, and they'd shared their stories. They'd been friends for 10 years. Neither one of them had ever shared. One of them had a brother that was in prison, and the other had a mother or a father that was in prison, but it was kind of like this dirty secret that they'd never shared with each other. And suddenly they were able to openly talk about it. And another event I was at, a girl came to me and she said, thank you so much. She said, your story could have been my mother's story. My mother could have been standing there, you know, telling that same story. She said, that's what I grew up with. And she said, and I never shared it with anybody, not even my husband. And she said, you know, we're newly married. This is my husband. And I just told him. And I was like, wow. It's the sharing of the stories that enables everybody to get rid of the shame associated with it, because it's touching everybody. And if we put it in the closet and pretend it doesn't exist, then that just allows it to continue to be a black mark on the people, on the family, and on our country.
Hey, Warners, you have probably heard me talk on several occasions about how much I love wearing red lipstick. Lipstick is just one of those things that makes me feel good about how I look. And sometimes a little extra enhancement to my lips from Dermavogue doesn't hurt either. I've known Dr. Jim Turek of Dermavogue for years. He is not only my doctor who keeps my body healthy, he and his Dermavogue team keep my face looking healthy. And maybe a little younger, maybe. I mean, I love it when people say, something looks different about your face. But they can't really tell, because that's really what you want. You want to go to a place that makes your face look as good and it makes people wonder what happened. So what's really cool about Dermavogue being our premier sponsor of this show is the fact that I'm a client, and I was a client before they became a partner of the show. So we're excited about that. Dermavogue has been offering the greater Myrtle Beach area the best in cosmetic and aesthetic dermatology since 2003. Opened by Dr. James Turek, Dermavogue combines expert medical knowledge with cutting-edge technology, bringing you the most effective, flawless solutions to any skincare or cosmetic need. Their patients enjoy only the absolute best in laser technology, including photodynamic laser therapy, hydrofacials, and V-beam laser treatments, as well as the latest fillers such as Botox, skin peels, facials, and more. At Dermavogue, they engage you in the process of total body health to ensure your satisfaction with their comprehensive selection of the most up-to-date, non-invasive cosmetic, dermatology, and spa treatments. It's human nature to want to look your best, right? Let Dermavogue help you get there. Schedule your consultation today by calling 843-357-2444 or visit dermavogue.com and tell them that the Women Your Mother Warned You About sent you. You can also find them on our website. Go check it out.
Michelle, I was wondering why the focus on female prisoners, women prisoners. You know, this is Women Your Mother Warned You About. My mother certainly warned me about. who was careful. My mother was very straight laced. So why Televerde's focus on female prisoners?
You know, that's one of the number one questions I get asked all the time. So originally, it was just by chance. That's where the gentleman was doing prison ministries. That's where it started. Then over the years, because today we have 400 women in prison working for us. We have 5 of our 9 contact centers are located in women's prisons. So over the years, as we were expanding as a company and the growth was organic and dynamic because it was, you know, just as businesses grow. So we kept expanding each call center inside of the facility where we were at. And you know that when you're doing stuff like this, being able to knowledge transfer, knowledge share, the peer group, it was just easier for us to grow and expand within the environment that we were at. Then we started to recognize the fundamental nature of women. And the way that the women were nurturing and encouraging and paying it forward to help each other to be successful. So in the call centers themselves, not only were the women supporting each other, rather than competing with each other, I'm going to be successful and you're not. They were literally supporting each other to be successful because it represented an opportunity for each person to be successful. But it was more than that. They were actually out on the yard recruiting each other to come work for us and doing what they needed to do to teach and help the women be prepared to be able to come and work for us so that they could have the opportunity. So that's why that's kind of what kept it moving along the way. And then now from where we are today, when we sit back and we look and we think, okay, how do we want to expand? Where do we want to expand? I'm not opposed to supporting men in any fashion, but of the 2.3 million people that are currently incarcerated, only 10% of them are women. And so as a result of that, they're kind of a forgotten population in the prison system. They have less access to programs. The programs that they have tend to be very male-oriented because everything was designed for the men. So like, for example, the state of Texas, who's done wonderful things in the area of criminal justice reform, they have 29 different programs available for the men, including getting their MBAs while they're in prison. They have 2 for the women. The women can learn to be administrative assistants or they can do culinary classes. So they can type and they can cook. So
I can't even.
I can't stand it, can you? Right. So, and then on top of that, 4 out of 5 women in prison are mothers.
No, I can't do either of those very well. I'm not going to go to prison to learn.
Yeah. So the other things is 4 out of 5 women in prison are mothers. 66% of those children are under the age of 18. And the biggest difference between the men and the women is the men, nobody's expecting baby daddy to come home and collect the kids. But they are expecting mom to come home and get those kids. And so we know that if we can really empower them, the women, to be able to take care of themselves, take care of their families, that we can break the generational cycle of crime and incarceration. And then the kids will be less likely, they'll be more likely to graduate from high school. We've watched the women of Televerde put their children my office today. Her son was just valedictorian at his high school. And so then the children are less likely to go to prison. And that's the impact that's going to have a bigger impact on our community than anything else.
Michelle, do you think there's a higher percentage of kids that will eventually go to prison because their mom or their dad?
I don't know if that you found a stat that I don't know. it's more along the lines of what happens after prison, I think, is what's going to be the biggest predictor to it. Is how do the parents recover and behave after they get out of prison?
And I would venture to say during, because when you were telling your story, I actually it brought tears to my eyes when you mentioned your children. And, you know, I have a history that I possibly could have probably gone to prison with some of the stuff I was pulling, but I'm not there anymore. But the thought of standing there and getting, being taken from my children for the next 7 years, or my child, how did you cope with that? And how did you communicate with your children while incarcerated? And how do you feel it affected them?
You almost made me cry in thinking about it. So there's,
I'm sorry.
So oftentimes, that's okay. When I talk about these things, I never, like, I'm a big crybaby and I cry about things all the time. So it doesn't, it's no big
we
deal.
We do too. So it's okay. Including Keith. So it's okay.
I know I'm going to cry again.
So my, so there's a lot of things that kind of are important to the background, backstory of all of this with my children. And two things is I married my high school sweetheart. And we had two kids, and I left him because I wanted more out of life. I wanted a bigger house. I wanted a better car. I wanted more money, a better job. And so I left my husband in the search of this better life, which is what led me to where I was. And in that process, he ended up taking custody of the kids from me. So at the time when I got sentenced, I had already lost custody of the kids. But then he came from, when you think about the concept of a dysfunctional family, he was the poster child for that growing up in every sense of the word. But he made some key decisions when I got sentenced, and that was that he was going to change his own life so that nothing could ever happen to get the kids taken away from him. And then when I got sentenced, he decided that he'd grown up without a father. And everybody had badmouthed his father when he was growing up, and he really resented it, and he didn't want my boys to have that same experience. So he committed that he would do whatever he needed to enable the kids to maintain a relationship with me through phone calls and visits while I was incarcerated, and that he would never badmouth me or allow anybody else to badmouth me to the kids. That was probably one of the key things that really is one of the tipping points in my life. And so through the process of him coming to visit with the kids and the kids coming to visit me, we actually fell in love again. And that's so stupid. I'm such a crybaby. And when I got out, our anniversary was just the other day. We got remarried and put our family back together. And so just last month, we celebrated the 17th anniversary of our second marriage. And when we're in Costa Rica, we'll celebrate the 32nd anniversary of our first marriage. And my two boys are two of the most amazing men in the world. So they are 28 and 31 years old now. Probably about 6 months after I came home, Samson, who's my youngest, we were out Christmas shopping, and he popped his face in from the back seat of the car, and he says, "You know, Mama," he says, "I can't even remember what it was like for you not to be here. It just feels like we've always been a family." And so, and they've grown up to be wonderful. My oldest one is a career military. He's been serving our country for 13 years. My younger one, Samson, he actually worked here at Televerde for about 5 years. He, after graduating from college, he moved to Terre Haute, Indiana, and helped open the call centers in the women's prison in Rockville, and worked with the women there for a few years. And today he's married to a beautiful young lady who's a Phoenix police officer. So completely different world than what you would have ever imagined my children to be when they were young.
That's amazing. And it's so powerful. And I hope people really, a lot of people get the chance to hear this, because there's so much darkness and like fear and darkness and ugliness is the idea that most people have when they think of someone who's been incarcerated, and they don't get exposed to something so beautiful and positive that could result if it's handled properly and people are rehabilitated in a positive way rather than just put in a box and sat on a shelf, that they're a disaster of a human.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I think too often, and I see it quite a bit, is too often people, they'll make the decision that, oh, you know what, you're in prison and you're not going to be allowed to see your children, not going to be able to talk to your children. And that's not helping the situation, right? And what happens when somebody goes to prison, it's all a matter of choice, you know? So for me and for so many of the women, when I got there, I met with my counselor and he said to me, he said, you can choose to do your time however you want. You can worry about how to fit in here and what other people think of you, or you can use this time to become the best version of yourself, which is really what I did. You know, and that's where I focused my energy is how do I use this time to overcome the mistakes I made in my past? And that's what you see with so many of the men and women in prison. If they're like, okay, I'm in the worst spot in my life, how do I fix this mess?
Michelle, when we first talked, you told me that it was kind of shocking because you didn't think you would get the maximum sentence.
Yeah.
And you got the maximum sentence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the day that I went to court, all the things, my lawyer, I negotiated a plea agreement that, and we thought that I was going to get 3.5 years or possibly 4.5 years. I'd already been in for a year while I was going to court. And so I actually thought that when we went into court that day that I'd get the 3.5 year sentence and I'd be home. By the time everything worked out, I'd be home in about a year. And we went into court that day, and my dad, my family, friends, my ex-husband all stood up and talked about, you know, the fact that I was a good girl and I had a good support system and all of those things. And so when I stood up to get sentenced, the judge said to me, he said, you know, I've heard what everybody said here today and they're right. You do know the difference between right and wrong. And you do have a good support system. And he said, and for that reason, I'm going to give you the maximum sentence of 7 years. So it was that moment that is literally the moment that I knew my life was changed forever. I remember when I left the courtroom, and I kind of refer to it as my darkest hour, but trying to come to terms with why it happened. And the only thing I could do is grab on to, you know, my mom used to tell me everything happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. And I remember telling myself as I sat there that, okay, this happened for a reason. There's something so important and so significant about this that I had to get 7 years. And I remember telling myself it could be something that happens, a conversation between me and another person on the 364th day of the sixth year that is absolutely life-changing for either that person or for me, and that I may never even know who it is or what it is, what it was, but I just have to accept the fact that it had to happen that way. As I look back in hindsight, I absolutely know 100% why it had to happen that way. I didn't start working for Televerde until there was about three and a half years left on my sentence when I got the job at Televerde. And it's through that. Had I gotten a 3.5 year sentence or a 4 year sentence, I never would have had the opportunity to work at Televerde. And I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you today. And I wouldn't have the opportunity to touch all the lives that I have, both the women in prison and sharing the stories with the community and the world at large to help open the minds and win the hearts of others.
That's so huge, that what you said about everything happens for a reason, because no matter what happens, happens to anyone in life. And so many people, as you said, are incarcerated. And unfortunately, so many people choose to be angry and blame everybody else and slide down the slippery dark slope, for lack of a better analogy, but you can choose to redirect your life. I mean, that's like Nelson Mandela did the same thing for years and years. Like, he chose to not blame the people that persecuted him and went on for better things. And that goes for all areas of life. And there's so many people that have such less important things that happen in their lives that they just, it's so dramatic and they just make such drama about these horrible things that befall them instead of going, okay, there's a reason for this. What can I learn? How can I grow? How can I use this to better myself? And you're a shining example for many about how you can do that, obviously. It's great.
Well, and I think, like Keith said as well, everything happens for a reason, but it's also our responsibility to own our outcomes, right? And I own what happens next in my life. And I can choose to be a victim and allow the world to happen to me, or I can choose to make my own path and make the decisions about where I'm going and what I'm doing and how I handle things. So, and that's, everybody has that, regardless of whether you're in prison or you're in a bad marriage or you hate your job or any of those things, the outcome is yours to drive, and you can't blame anybody else for it.
Going back to skills gap, what are some things that companies can do to help women and men in this situation? And is there something more that the prison systems can do?
Well, there's always more that the prison systems can do. There's tons of things the prison systems can do. But without getting into that kind of political foray, we focus on, you know, what businesses can do and what can individuals do. You know, businesses, as a general rule of thumb, can ban the box. And that's a movement that's taking place all over the country. But if you're not familiar with what it is, there's the box on a job application or an online application. And so when you fill out it says, you know, have you ever been convicted of a felony? It seems that this is kind of benign. If you've never been convicted of one, it doesn't matter. But if you have, it means everything, because it can make or break your chances of getting employment. For example, a few years ago, I guess probably about 4 or 5 years ago now, I was being heavily recruited for an executive level position that I was candidly overqualified for. But in the process, in discussions with the recruiter, and he's like, okay, I need you to go online and fill out the formal thing online in order to continue the process and, you know, set up the next round of interviews with the executives. And so I go online and sure enough, there's the question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And I'm like, well, this can't possibly matter. I mean, this was a crime I committed in 1995. Like, these people weren't even born yet. and sure enough, I checked the box and it literally kicked me out of the system and thanked me for my interest in the job.
Is that legal?
Yeah, sure is. Yeah, because they just say, well, you're not qualified because of, you know, whatever reason. They can come up with whatever reason why it you wouldn't be a fit because of that. Maybe there's some financial things or some confidential information. And so taking that off the application process altogether, so that you, at the very first, you're giving all qualified candidates a chance. So get everybody through the process, pick the person you think is most likely for the job, and then do the background check. And when you do the background check, only check for things that are relevant to the job that you're hiring for. And so there's a great organization called Checker that enables companies to set up their background screenings to only screen for things that would matter to the actual job that they're hiring for. So that's kind of the first thing. Then the other is, you know, you can be actually more proactive in saying, I'm going to go find the population of people then and help them. You know, the governments provide tax credits and funding for organizations that hire people who've been convicted of felony. There's very specific tax credits that are available. There's also protection against companies. Everybody's afraid, like, oh, what if I hire this person and then there's a problem and I could get sued? They've actually passed a law that says that can't be brought into the discussion in any sort of a business situation like that as part of the lawsuit. And so identifying what jobs are you going to need in the future and invest the time to find people and train them and give them the training that they need to do the jobs that you need, because I tell you, you'll get some of the most engaged, loyal, and committed employees when you invest in them in that way.
Especially when nobody else is.
Yeah. Because honestly, the last thing they want to do is have to go look for a job again.
If only there were a tenth, a 100th of the amount of money being spent on creating artificial intelligence to do the kinds of jobs that people that are incarcerated would just love to have that job and have to fight tooth and nail to get it.
Yeah. And so then, you know, then there's other opportunities. One of the things that I'm working on a personal level is how can I personally go out and help other companies start and build what I call a prison to workforce pipeline. And there's two kind of examples of what I would consider a prison to workforce pipeline. One is the example of what Televerde does, where we actually have an extension of our business in the prison. So we're providing them jobs, training, education while they're incarcerated, and then enabling them to transition in those jobs here to our corporate office, or supporting them getting employed out by our customers or people in the local community. And then the other is, there's an organization called The Last Mile who's doing a very good job of this, where it's setting up training programs inside the prison specific for job skills that you're going to need as an organization. The Last Mile is teaching computer coding. And so they're in about, I think, 5 different states right now, where they go in and they actually teach the coding and get people certified and then help with the job placements to go be computer programmers, which they're all making more money than anybody else right now. And they're having great success with 0% recidivism for the folks that have gone through that program. So thinking, it's about changing the way you think about things. And so where can I go find talent and teach them to do the jobs that I need in the future?
Yeah, it definitely is a change to what you're thinking about. My former company, we had the box. If somebody checked the box, we never saw the resume. In traditional business, there's a lot of liability concerns, and there's, you know, there the concerns of other employees, you know, sensitivities and so forth. So when you're talking with, you know, companies, CEOs and so forth, how do you make that argument around the liability argument and around the how the other employees accept, you know, once the folks may be out of incarceration and in the work environment?
Well, there's so to the liability standpoint, there's actually laws. There's laws in place that are designed to protect the businesses from lawsuits that are associated with hiring this population. So that one, you know, it's really just about talking about that and understanding what is the concerns and addressing them head on and saying, okay, well, this isn't something that becomes a liability of the company. As far as the other employees, there's a couple glib ways of handling it, but you know, everybody who's ever, all the people who've ever gone in and shot up the workplace and because they were a disgruntled employee, none of them were formerly incarcerated. So there's kind of one thing there. And then when you think about need to know, right? There's this whole need to know. So you think about if somebody comes to work for your organization and they have a terminal disease, or they have hepatitis, or like, you wouldn't go share that with the rest of the employees. So why would there be a need to share with the rest of the employees that somebody had once been to prison for, or whatever it was they had been to prison for? So that it's, it's if you treat it the same way you treat anything else, you know, oh, well, they're on psych meds. Well, you wouldn't share that around the office. So.
No, it's very good points. And I think, you know, this is one of the interesting aspects or things that happened at the conference was this question being talked about quite a bit and, you know, processing that, you know, it's certainly has impacted the way I look at it. And just the availability of talent is so slim today. It's an exciting way to look at how you face that.
What more can we do as individuals, just the individual citizen?
You know, I think from an individual citizen standpoint, it's for me, as I've kind of expanded into this new version of my role, because I used to be the chief marketing officer. And so I just talked about marketing and business and all of that. And when I moved into this space and I started learning about the facts about incarceration and employment and the women and all of the different issues, it opened my mind, and as much as I'd been around this for 20 years, it opened my mind in a way that I just didn't realize the situation. And so now that I know, I can't unknow what I know. And so it just makes me talk about it more. And the more that I talk about it, the more minds that open and you know, win the hearts. I think that's what the average citizen really needs to think about is, okay, do I know what's going on in my own community? Am I talking about it? Can I help promote open dialogue about this topic? Can I influence in my own workplace and in my own community to help erase the stigma associated with this?
So Michelle, one question I have is more of a business related question. What lesson did you learn in prison that has served you so well in business since then? So a lesson maybe that other women or folks don't have to go to prison to learn because you can relate it to us.
You know what? I think there's kind of three things that I think about from kind of a business standpoint. And number one is I would say you have to attract a coach. And by that, I mean, you know, everybody wants to have a mentor but you have to actually attract the coach, right? You can't just walk up and say, hey, excuse me, will you be my mentor? I mean, you can, but there's got to be a synergy in that relationship and an accountability in that relationship. And once you do that, you got to take the feedback from the coach, even when you don't always agree with it, and apply it and learn it and work through it. And that's what makes for a really good coaching relationship. For me, my coach was our former CEO, Jim Hooker. He was my best friend, my coach, my mentor, a lot of things for a lot of years. And he, you know, he held me accountable and he drove me hard and he was always honest with me. And I didn't always agree with him, but I took the feedback and I learned from it. The other thing that I always think about is that I like to say eat adversity for breakfast. You know, every day, every week, every month, every year, there's challenges and there's changes in business. And my career has been a progression. So I started on the phones. I was a sales rep. I ran sales, ran operations, ran marketing for a while, moved here. I didn't always like what I was doing or the challenges that were in front of me. Some of them, they were hard. They were bigger than I ever felt I was capable for more often than not. And you know what? It's every day, work hard, learn, and overcome the challenges that are in front of you. I mean, that's what it takes. You've got, and ask for help along the way. You know, so that's kind of the three components is work hard, learn, and ask for help and support. Ask the questions along the way in order to be successful. And then the last one is you have to become a coach. So once you get to that point in your life, you have to turn around and pay it forward, and you have to put a hand out to the men and the women that are coming up behind you and offer your support and your wisdom and knowledge where you can.
That's killer. And it goes along with, if you look at any type of recovery program for drugs, alcohol, what have you, there's always an aspect of being a sponsor, which is becoming a coach for somebody else so that you can continue to pay it forward. And everybody needs a good coach, and everybody should be a good coach for sure. But I love that attract a coach. That's the first time I've ever heard anybody say that. Everyone will say, get a coach, but nobody reminds you that you must become the type of person that a coach wants to work with.
Yeah. And then, and you have to maintain that relationship. It's not just a given. You know, there's this constant back and forth. It's almost like you think about friendships over the years. They wane if you don't, feed them and nurture them. And it's the same thing with your, your mentoring relationships. Is you have to maintain the relationship. It's give and take.
What would be the best advice that someone gave you, aside from what you just mentioned? That's the advice you'd give others, but what was there any great advice that someone specifically gave you?
A gal who was my roommate while I was doing time, I decided that I was going to get my college degree, and I was taking correspondence classes. And literally I was taking algebra and human biology with nothing more than a textbook and a pad of paper and a syllabus. And in doing my algebra, I reached this point of just sheer frustration, and I was ready to quit. And she, through the conversation, and she basically yelled at me and told me, you know what, anything that's worth having in your life isn't going to be easy, and you have to be able to just step up and overcome the challenge if you're going to be successful in achieving your goals. And she probably wasn't quite that succinct in her saying it, but it's advice that has stuck with me forever, is that, anything in my life that is worth having, that any goal that I've set, if I'm serious about it, it's not going to be easy, and I've got to do the hard work necessary to achieve it.
Amen.
There may be some women, some people listening to this podcast who may be engaging in, and I can't remember what you called it, a certain type of entrepreneurship that's not legal at this point. And it hasn't come home to roost yet. Any advice or comments that you would give to those individuals that are listening?
Wow. It's, take that same level of energy and time and commitment to the work that you're doing, and apply it to your own personal self-improvement and personal and professional development, and you can leave all of that stuff behind you. But as long as you're walking in the swamp, you're going to have wet shoes, and it's never going to lead anywhere good.
Michelle, thank you so much for your time today. If people want to learn more about you or Televerde or getting involved with helping move this forward, what are the best ways to reach out or connect?
You can connect with me on Twitter, which is at M Sirocco. LinkedIn, I probably spend more time on LinkedIn than any of the other social media. That's where I do most of my posting and personal connections. So connect with me there. And then, of course, the Televerde website, just www.televerde.com.
Well, it's time for us to wrap up this show. So we're going to wrap it up. We're going to thank Michelle one more time. And thank you to all of our Warners for listening today to this episode of Women Your Mother Warned You About. Oh, one last reminder to our listeners. Also on our website, you can find a link to iTunes where you can leave us a rating and review in case we have not mentioned that enough. And Warners, keep on keeping it sexy. And remember, for the best relationships, keep it real, raw, and relevant.
And a little irreverence doesn't hurt either.
Bye, Warners.
Bye.
Bye, Keith.
Bye.
Bye, Rachel.
Bye, ladies.
This really will get serious soon.
Yeah, I don't think. It doesn't have to. I don't think anybody wants it to be serious.